Good morning. The Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement will come to order. Welcome, everyone. We have a very fascinating hearing this morning, and I appreciate everybody attending. I believe a few more are going to be coming in as we go on. You have your agenda in your packets, members. The first thing is, number one, the approval of the January 24th, 2018 meeting minutes. Do I have a motion for that approval?
Move approval.
Senator Pappas moves the January 24th meetings. All those say aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Our second agenda, members, is our guest, Alex Brown. He's from the National Association of State Retirement Administrators, NASRA. Welcome, Mr. Brown. You come all the way from Washington, D.C., and you're going to be talking about the public pension trends. I do just have a little bit of a summary on him. He is the research manager for NASRA, where he is responsible for collecting and updating data and contributing to fact sheets and other research materials which help inform the public pension community. He's also co-authored papers on public pension and retiree health care, including strengthening state and local government finances, lessons for negotiating public pension plan reforms, and also understanding finances and changes in retiree health care. So with that, Mr. Brown, welcome. Thank you so much for making this trip to Minnesota, where you're getting a healthy dose of our wonderful weather. But it's not bad because the wind isn't blowing. So,
thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Commission. Just by way of background, the National Association of State Retirement Administrators, or NASRA, is a professional association for the executive directors of the nation's largest state and statewide public employee retirement systems. Collectively, NASRA members are responsible for more than two-thirds.
Yep. Excuse me.
Oh. Sound? Can you hear me here?
Is this better? Okay.
Can we turn it up?
Yeah, Mr. Brown, speak right into it, that'd be great. Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So collectively, NASRA members are responsible for more than two-thirds of the of all of the assets and all of the members in the public retirement system community. NASRA counts among its members the executive directors of the three statewide retirement systems here in Minnesota, the State Retirement System, the Public Employees Retirement Association, and the Teachers Retirement Association. I'm here as a representative of the research office. Broadly speaking, our objective is to collect and disseminate information and data on a range of public retirement system topics pertaining to administration and policy. And so I'm here to share some of our research observations with you this morning. I appreciate the Commission's interest in our work, appreciate the invitation to address you this morning. If you have questions throughout my presentation, please feel free to interrupt and ask them, or we can address them at the end of my prepared remarks. I'd like to begin with a high-level overview of summary statistics of the public retirement system universe. Most of this information is sourced from the U.S. Census Bureau as of FY16, unless otherwise noted. As of the third quarter of 2017, the Federal Reserve reports that public defined benefit plans hold approximately $4.2 trillion in assets. Assets of public defined benefit plans are a key source of liquidity in the capital market and a source of economic stability in every state and many cities across the country. Census reports 14.5 million active or working participants participating in public defined benefit plans as of FY16. This is a figure that represents approximately 10 to 13% of the nation's overall workforce. 10 million retirees and their survivors received over $280 billion in benefits in FY16, and in FY16 annual contributions to public defined benefit plans totaled $190 billion. And I provided the employer-employee breakdown: 75%, $140 billion, contributed from public employers. That includes states, cities, universities, school districts, and other employers. The remaining quarter, $50 billion, contributed from employees. As of FY15, the latest year for which we have this data available, approximately 4.6% of all state and local spending went to pensions nationwide. The median benefit multiplier. Benefit multiplier, along with years of service and final salary, is a key determinant in the size of an individual's pension benefit on a median basis. Multiplier for general employees and teachers who participate in Social Security, 1.8%. Median age for age-based normal retirement for a similar group, age 63. Slide 3 identifies similar statistics for public pension plans here in Minnesota. I'm not going to read all of these to you, but I do want to point out a couple items. The first is the annual contributions of $2.3 billion. In Minnesota, pension contributions are more evenly split between employers and employees than they are nationwide. Approximately 40% of all pension contributions in FY16 to Minnesota defined benefit pension plans were contributed by employees. Spending on pensions is also much lower here in Minnesota than it is nationwide, 2.3% in FY15 compared to the 4.6% identified for the nationwide figure. Benefit multiplier is at or around the median level for Minnesota plans, 1.7% for SRS, para, TRA service prior to July 1st, 2006, 1.9 for TRA service after that date. And employees in Minnesota must reach a higher age to qualify for age-based normal retirement. Normal retirement is the ability to retire with an unreduced pension benefit. Here in Minnesota, normal retirement age tied to Social Security, normal retirement age, which differs depending on one's date of birth, but is capped at age 66. Slide 4 identifies 4 notable public pension trends and will also serve as a brief outline for the rest of my presentation. We observe a wide disparity in funding levels and actuarial funding levels and costs for public pension plans across the country. In most states, public pensions are not a source of fiscal stress. The relatively small number of states that do face fiscal challenges related to their pension plans tend to receive a disproportionate amount of attention relative to their size. And additionally, in states where pension challenges are present, the problems that they face are varied. We also observe an increased effort on the part of employers to fund their pension plans, both through making higher contributions, but also through other methods that I'll identify later. As a result of numerous pension reforms enacted primarily since 2009, public employees bear more risk for funding and managing their retirement income. Additionally, pension reforms have introduced increasing complexity to the public pension plan universe, resulting in multiple tiers, use of new plan designs, and other changes. And finally, the investment return assumption is being evaluated and reduced by a large number of pension plans, again, particularly since 2009, in light of macroeconomic developments and expected developments pertaining to capital market return assumptions. This chart identifies the latest public pension actuarial funding levels for FY16. This chart includes 121 of the largest state and local pension plans that we regularly monitor. Each bubble on this chart represents one pension plan, and the size of the bubbles is roughly proportionate to the size of the plan's liabilities. So larger bubbles equal larger plans, smaller bubbles equal smaller plans. The relative position of the 3 statewide systems here in Minnesota is identified for your reference. So as you can see, the range on this chart is quite large. On the low end, one plan is funded at 19%. On the high end, 111%. It's worth noting that the funding level receives a lot of attention. It is the most widely recognized and popular metric of the fiscal condition of a pension plan. But it is not by itself a reliable indicator of that plan's condition. More information is needed, such as trends in funding level, as well as trends in current and required costs. So in the spirit of that sentiment, this chart identifies median contribution rates paid by employees and employers. This chart identifies trends as well since FY02. The employer and employee rates for the three statewide systems here in Minnesota are also included for reference. This data pertains to contribution rates for general employees and teachers covered by Social Security. Not included in this data are contribution rates for public safety employees, which tend to be higher, corresponding with higher benefits, or other narrow groups of public employees, such as judges or legislators. Focusing first on the employee trend line, the red line on the bottom. As I mentioned in my opening remarks, there have been a number of pension reforms enacted by nearly every state since 2009, and one of the most common changes was an increase to required employee contribution rates. This trend is evidenced on this line by an increase to 6%, approximately 6% in FY12, following a long period where the median employee contribution rate was 5%. Focusing on employer contribution rates on the blue line over top, employer contribution rates have increased steadily throughout this period. FY02 marked was at or near an all-time low point in employer contribution rates following two previous decades where capital market performance was relatively robust. The next decade, the 2000s, would feature two economic recessions, which reduced the value of public plan assets and pushed required employer contribution rates higher.
Mr. Brown.
Yes.
Yeah, we have a question. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Then it looks like from this chart that Minnesota is really unusual and that our employee and our employee rates are close to or the same, and that's not true mostly across the country.
Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, thank you, and Senator Pappas. Going back to my slide that presented the summary statistics, the typical breakdown for contributions on an aggregate basis nationwide is 75% employer, 25% employee. In Minnesota, it's closer to 60-40 breakdown. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
And Mr. Brown, I do have a question back on page 3, slide 3, that in FY15, approximately 2.3% of all state local was spent on pensions. Does that include the state aid, and is that would be the same for nationwide to your figure of 4.6? Does that include the state aid figure?
Thank
everything?
You. That's a good question. This data is sourced from the U.S. Census Bureau. We do our best to account for only spending that is that could be classified as discretionary. So we try to exclude items such as intergovernmental transfers, funds that are more or less on autopilot and would not be available to fund pensions. It's possible that there are some non-discretionary funds in the denominator in that equation. But to maybe answer your question more pointedly, the calculation is standardized for both the aggregate figure and the figure here in Minnesota.
Okay.
Uses the same set of data.
Well, I'd like to take credit for that question, but it came from Ms. Lincheski. My question is maybe a little more stupid. And back to page 5, the big circle in the middle, I'm a little confused. Is Minnesota's circles little? Because apparently size of bubble is roughly proportionate to size of plan liabilities. We have little bubble, right? Little liability.
The large circle.
Yeah, what is that?
In the middle is the California Public Employees Retirement System, largest retirement system in the country.
That's a good question.
And it appears to be consuming the PERA and the TRA, yes, which are much smaller bubbles corresponding with their size.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Okay. Further questions? Great.
It's also worth mentioning, as it pertains to this chart, that benefit levels vary among retirement systems. Employee contribution rates vary, and therefore employer costs also vary. Additionally, some employers pay the full required contribution, some employers do not. So these are important considerations to keep in mind when comparing the rates for Minnesota statewide systems to the national medians.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam. On this
which...
Oh, sorry, the chart that you just had up. That does not include the Social Security amounts that employers and employees also contribute as well. Is that correct,
Mr. Brown?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, that's a good question. These contribution rates do not include Social Security contributions.
Thank
these
you.
Are just pension contributions.
Okay. Mr. Brown.
So the next couple slides will focus on employer contributions and more specifically the adequacy of employer contributions compared to the amounts recommended by actuaries. This chart depicts the annual required contribution / actuarially determined employer contribution experience for FY01 to FY15, the latest year for which we have this data available. Just a little bit about the metrics. You'll notice that there are two metrics indicated on this chart. Following its introduction by the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, the GASB, in the late 1990s, the annual required contribution, or the ARC, became sort of an unofficial measuring stick for pension funding progress. Effective in FY14 for retirement systems, the GASB eliminated the ARC as a required disclosure and replaced it with the actuarially determined employer contribution, or the ADC. We consider that there are some subtle differences in these metrics, but by and large, they are substantively similar. So we continue our time series tracking the adequacy of ARC or ADC over time. The ARC or ADC can be further defined by their component parts, the normal cost or the cost of benefits accrued in a given year, and an amortization payment to eliminate any existing unfunded liability in accordance with the system's amortization schedule and policy. So with that background, we observe that on a median basis, the level of ARC or ADC received by this chart includes 112 plans, by the way. On a median basis, the amount of ARC or ADC received never fell below 90% in any year in this graph. And that's noteworthy because, as I mentioned a couple slides ago, this was a pretty eventful period that featured two capital market declines, which, as I mentioned, pushed required pension costs higher, and also two economic recessions, which significantly constrained the ability of public employers to make their required pension contributions while continuing to fund other core government services. The weighted average line, this is a dollar-weighted average weighted for plan size. On a weighted average basis, the performance of plan contributions was considerably worse. This reflects the fact that several very large pension plans were among those that were the most conspicuously underfunded during this period. However, it is worth noting, and I do so by including this red trend line, that in each of the past 3 years, so since FY13, the amount of ARC or ADC received by the plans in our sample has increased on a weighted average basis. This is not to indicate an expectation for future contributory experience, just noting the trend from the past 3 years.
Senator Sinjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Brown, I don't need a long explanation, but you just talked a long time, and I was trying to figure out what ARC meant and what ADC meant. Maybe just tell me, what is the message of this slide? Because I got lost about 5 minutes ago. And I don't know if I'm alone or not.
You are not alone, Senator Sinjum. Mr. Brown.
What just is the message? What does this slide tell you or tell us? What should it tell us?
Chair, Senator, good question. So this chart is a very high-level overview of the contributory experience for 112 of the largest state and local pension plans that we regularly monitor. This chart is tracking the percentage of contributions received by these plans relative to the contributions that are required or recommended by the plan's actuaries. So, for example, in FY01, on a weighted average basis, so accounting for the size of the plans in the sample, our sample received over 100% of their required contributions in FY01. And then you can see that relative percentage of contributions received begins to decline, rises again, before declining further, and then in the past 3 years has begun to rise again.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yeah. That was
thank
helpful.
You. Very much. Mr. Brown, further questions? Mr. Brown.
This chart on slide 8 reflects the ADC experience for FY15 only. So we're taking 1 year from the prior chart and representing that graphically here on slide 8. Again, you can see that on a median basis, the median plan received 100% of its ADC in FY15. Weighted average was 91%. This is the highest weighted average value observed since FY02. So again, this reflects 3 years of continued improvement in contributory experience for the plans that we track. But this chart also allows you to see the range. So you can see on the low end, you've got several plans. This is, again, 112 plans. Each bar represents one plan. And you can see on the low end, we've got plans that received below 50%, some even below 25%. Of their required contributions in FY15. And then on the high end, the two outliers there usually provoke interest. Those are the Alaska Public Employees and Teachers Retirement Systems, which received a collective $3 billion in surplus budget funds in FY15. So that's why they appear so high. But then you can see even irrespective of those two outliers, there are several plans that received more than 100% of their required contributions in FY15. I've also noted the relative position of the three statewide systems in Minnesota, and they are below both the median and the weighted average, but there are a few things worth noting about that. Employer pension contributions here in Minnesota are established as a fixed percentage of covered salary established in statute. For many other plans in our sample, employer pension contributions are determined by the amount recommended by the plan's actuaries, the ADC in this instance. So while the three systems here in Minnesota are below the median and weighted average by this metric, the ADC is essentially not a funding target for the systems here in Minnesota. So they aren't necessarily falling short of a target goal. And furthermore, several of the plans that received a lower percentage of their ADC than plans in Minnesota are funded on the basis of the ADC. So they, you know, did fall considerably short of their funding target. It's also worth noting with regard to the ARC or the ADC that not all ARCs or ADCs are calculated in a uniform manner. They're highly dependent on a number of different assumptions, most notably the length of the amortization period. And I'll get into that a little bit later on in my remarks, but generally a shorter amortization period is expected to eliminate unfunded liability more rapidly than a longer amortization period, and as a result can result in higher required contributions relative to plans that use a longer period. So all worth noting when observing and interpreting the information on this chart.
Mr. Brown, what is the average amortization period? Where does Minnesota's fall in that? Are we short or long? Through the year.
Good question, Madam Chair. I'll have an answer on the average amortization period in a couple slides. I don't have the information for Minnesota, but I expect that the retirement systems do have that.
Okay, thank you.
And slide 9 is my final slide on the ARC or ADC, and this breaks it down by state. This reflects the contributory experience of all 50 states for the entirety of our measurement period, FY01 to FY15. And again, you can see that the weighted average experience is much lower than the median. The median is 100%. Weighted average is a little over 85%. And this chart makes it a little bit easier to see why there is such a difference in those measures. If you look over to the left-hand side of the chart, you can see that several large states, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Washington, Colorado, and others, Illinois, are among the most underfunded. So those are several large states with large pension plans dragging down the weighted average relative to the median on this chart. The other side of the chart is also noteworthy, and I use this to make a point about the importance of receiving required pension contributions. Connecticut and Alaska occupy the top two positions on this chart, so they look like top performers. But the public pension plans in those states are considerably underfunded compared to the rest of the public retirement system universe. Connecticut looks like a top performer on this chart due to the issuance of a pension obligation bond, the proceeds of which were directed to the state's teacher retirement system, which had been underfunded for many years. In Alaska, as I mentioned on the preceding chart, the two outlier plans, the PERS and the TRS, received a one-time infusion of $3 billion from the state to fund to pay down their unfunded liabilities. So all of those funds are reflected in this chart, which is why they look like such a top performer on contributions. But they still have very underfunded pension plans. The point I'm trying to make is that had Alaska contributed those funds at the beginning of the period in FY01 rather than in FY15 when they did, the systems would have had the benefit of being able to invest those funds, generate compound investment returns, and they would probably have much better funded pension plans as a result. So, again, a point worth noting when interpreting this chart and where a certain state may lie on it.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Brown, I guess looking at this, I'm thinking that a one-year investment return would be influencing especially the ADC for fiscal year 15, whereas if you go over the longer period of time, it would be more of an average of those investment returns. And the reason I ask that is to kind of get a relevance which chart might be more helpful. My feeling has always been that we have to look at what we expect to earn over a long period of time rather than on a single year occurrence, because that's what's really going to make this thing sound in the future or not. So the question is the page 8, would that possibly be more dependent on a one-year fluctuation in the investment return where your ADC would change drastically, maybe based on that one-year return, whereas if we look at 9, where you've got 14 years of experience, you're averaging that out more and might be a better indication of where we're going overall with this.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, Representative Vogel, thank you. That's a good question. Public pension plans, for purposes of calculating required contributions, calculating the amount needed to fund the accrued benefits and amortize the unfunded liability, typically use a smooth value of assets to mitigate the impact of one extraordinary year of investment performance. Does that answer your question?
Representative Vogel.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. It does, and that is the methodology that's being used with these charts, and that's consistent with GASB?
Yes.
Mr. Brown. Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Brown.
This slide identifies several methods that states are using to amortize or eliminate their unfunded pension liabilities. This is not intended to comment on the efficacy of any of these particular approaches, just sharing some observations. Certainly, as I've discussed previously, we see an increase in the number of plans that are receiving a higher proportionate share of their relative actuarially determined contributions than we have in years past, which is encouraging. And then other states are using different approaches. I mentioned the example of Alaska, which received a one-time contribution of $3 billion split between its two statewide retirement systems from budget surplus funds. Pension obligation bonds, I mentioned, is an approach that was used in Connecticut and also more recently in Kansas. We see dedicated funding streams established in certain states. This is a particularly popular option in states whose revenues are dependent on taxes and levies on the extraction of natural resources. So Montana and Oklahoma are mentioned among these examples. And we see other dedicated revenues, such as dedicated sales and income taxes. And so this is a little bit of a departure from the way pensions are typically funded through annual appropriations or biennial appropriations. In this way, some states are attempting to establish a dedicated stream. So essentially the funds are on autopilot and not subject to discretionary appropriation. And finally, we see a number of changes to retirement system amortization policies, including changing the period or the method by which unfunded liabilities are amortized. And before I get into a little bit more detail on this, it's worth just spending a moment describing what an amortization policy is. Broadly speaking, a plan's amortization policy is the period, the length, and the structure devised for systematically eliminating a plan's unfunded pension liability over a length of time. In this way, funding a pension is analogous to paying off a mortgage. So just as home mortgages can be structured differently, there are mortgages with fixed interest rates, variable interest rates, different lengths of time, 15, 30 years, et cetera. So are pension plan amortization policies different?
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Mr. Brown, what are pension obligation funds? I don't know that I'm familiar with those.
Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair.
Bonds, yes.
Senator
pension
Pappas.
Obligation bonds.
Broadly speaking, a pension obligation bond is a bond issued by a governmental entity specifically for funding pension obligations, pension liabilities. So essentially the government issues the bonds and deposits the proceeds of the bond sale into the pension fund, where they are commingled with the rest of the plan's assets and invested.
And then,
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair and Mr. Brown, then, like any other bond sale, you have to pay those off over a period of years with
right.
interest.
Mr.
Right.
Brown.
The underlying strategy behind issuing a pension obligation bond is that the issuer expects to pay a lower rate of interest on the bond payments than it expects to earn, than the proceeds of the bond expect to earn in the pension fund. So you're expecting to fund through sort of interest rate arbitrage is the underlying strategy there.
Mr. Brown, what states are doing that?
I mentioned Kansas most recently issued, I believe, $1 billion pension obligation bond this past year or the year prior. There are a number of others that have utilized this approach in the past. I don't have any more specific examples, but I can get you more information on that if you're interested.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Chair. And what's the current payment to the bondholder? I mean, what's an approximate rate that the bondholder would get on that?
Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, Senator, thank you. Good question. I don't know. It would depend on a number of factors unique to the issuer of the bond, and I don't have an average or approximate rate. I'm sorry.
Mr. Brown, does NASRA go through these recommendations and give a thumbs up, thumbs down, any feedback on whether this is a solid idea or method to use to fund your liability?
Good question, Madam Chair. I should clarify, these are not NASRA recommendations. These are merely observations, things that we have observed that other states are doing to fund their pensions in a little bit different way than typical, perhaps. There are other organizations that might offer, you know, commentary on the efficacy of these particular approaches, but by and large, you know, they do depend on a set of individual circumstances and really can't be characterized as positive or negative in any kind of broad sense.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one follow-up question. So basically, if you're going to use these bonds, you're fixing in the rate that you're paying out, but you're guessing on the rate of return. So indeed, it's not really an arbitrage where it's a balanced transaction. The transaction for the payment of the interest is fixed, but the investment return may or may not be greater than what you, or lesser than what you think.
Mr. Brown.
Right? Correct. Question.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you for your question. Yeah, I suppose the interest rate that government is paying on its pension obligation bonds is fixed, and the rate of return that it expects to achieve on its pension assets is variable, although I will note that pension investing is a long-term enterprise. Public pension systems are long-term investors. Depending on the length of the bond issuance, that might the time horizons there might match up. I would also characterize the assumed rate of return employed by pension systems as a little bit something more than a guess. It's an estimate based on the expected performance of the capital market for the asset classes in which the pension funds are invested.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you. Not to belabor, but my suspicion would be that if you did these things and indeed in the first year or two you had lousy investment returns, you could start putting yourself in a hole of catch-up, and because it's not a solid arbitrage where you know fixed on both ends. You are variable on your yield end.
Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, thank you. You know, there are all sorts of considerations, you know, that a government needs to think about, you know, who's considering a pension obligation bond. And indeed, there are, you know, opinions on both sides. Some believe that pension obligation bonds should never be utilized in any circumstance. Others believe that they can be useful in certain circumstances. NASRA doesn't comment on that in either direction. It's really up to the individual government who's considering that and the sort of set of considerations that they face.
Well, Mr. Brown, I can say I am interested in your bullet point number 2, committing a portion of the budget surplus to the unfunded liability. I will be looking into that. So, thank you.
So I left off on amortization policy, and the next two charts will identify some trends that we observe with regard to changes to retirement system amortization policy. The first is a change in the use of amortization methods, and we identify two types of amortization methods on this chart, closed and open. A closed amortization period is essentially a fixed amortization period that expects to eliminate a system's unfunded liability over a specified time frame. By contrast, an open amortization period or a rolling amortization period essentially resets each year. And we can see this trend on this chart is fairly stark. Beginning in 2010 or so, we begin to see a pronounced shift from the use of open or rolling amortization periods to the use of closed amortization periods. And in 2016, approximately 80% of the plans in our sample are utilizing a closed amortization period, leaving 20% still using an open amortization period. Another critical factor in a plan's amortization policy is the length of the amortization period. This chart identifies the average length of amortization period in the blue line corresponding to the left vertical axis. As you can see, the average amortization period vacillates from year to year. It was as high as 28 years in 2004 or so, and then has pretty much begun to fall steadily since then. In FY16, the average amortization period is 24 years. We overlay this alongside a chart identifying the percentage of plans using closed amortization, so corresponding with the prior chart and corresponding with the right vertical axis on this chart. Again, you can see over 70%, approaching 80% of plans use closed amortization in FY16. The net effect of these changes is that retirement system amortization policies have become more, I'll use the word aggressive, in the sense that they are expected to eliminate existing unfunded liabilities more rapidly than perhaps they were in the past, when use of open or rolling amortization periods and longer amortization periods were more common.
Mr. Brown, this commission humbles me all the time. Can you just explain again what closed amortization means? What are we talking about here?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. This is a broad oversimplification. Amortization policy is very nuanced. It's very complex. It's necessary to have a background in actuarial sciences to explain all of the nuance thoroughly. But the simplified response to your question is that a closed amortization period is one in which the period is fixed. And that is to say that the unfunded liabilities can be expected to be eliminated by the end of the period.
Senator Pappas.
Maybe Ms. Lincheski could remind us what our amortization period is for our current plans, and then I think there's a proposal for a change probably in proposed legislation. Or is Ms. Barth? No.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Pappas. So the plans are on a 30-year fixed or closed amortization period, and so far the plans have ranged for how far they paid down, I think, between 18 and 25 years. And in the 2017 pension bill, it was extending the amortization period to kind of reset the 30 years.
Okay.
Mr. Brown.
So I want to shift the focus now to changes in plan retirement plan design, pension reforms. Since 2009, nearly every state has made a material change to its pension benefits, financing arrangements, or both. I should specify that reform in this instance does not imply improvement necessarily. Rather, it just pertains to a material change in one or more of the elements of the plan design, such as benefit levels, contribution rates, or other changes, eligibility requirements, and other. Broadly speaking, we see lower benefits and higher employee contributions as a result of these changes. It's also worth noting that, as we observed in a couple slides back, employer contribution rates have also increased considerably. In some cases, employer contribution rates have increased alongside required employer contributions in plans whose employer contribution rates are tied to required contributions, but also in plans whose employer contribution rates are established as a fixed percentage in statute, we have seen state legislatures addressing employer contribution rates through direct legislation. We also see an increased use of alternative plan designs, most notably hybrid plans, which I'll get into a little bit more detail in a moment. Limited use of defined contribution plans. In some cases, a defined contribution plan is a component of a hybrid plan, but so far we haven't seen a use of a standalone defined contribution plan for broad groups of public employees in most states. And one overarching trend of this period of pension reform is that a greater portion of the relative risk of accumulating retirement assets and managing retirement income has been transferred from employers to employees. Typical types of this risk include investment risk, the risk that investment returns will be below the level expected, mortality risk, the risk of running out of retirement income, and inflation risk, the risk of a retirement benefit whose value, whose purchasing power diminishes as inflation increases. So this is a first in a series of maps indicated, which are intended to indicate the scope of different types of common pension reforms observed around the country. First is states that increased employee contributions. It's also worth noting that with this and other maps, they do not indicate the degree of the change. In some cases, changes were more significant than in others. This is more intended to give a sense of the scope, which states took which actions. This map identifies 38 states that increased employee contributions. In some cases, the increases were temporary. In some cases, they were phased in. Some states now utilize variable contribution rates, so the employee contribution rate can essentially rise or fall automatically depending on one of several external factors, which can include the plan's funding condition or the performance of the plan's assets.
Mr. Brown, Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry. Back to page 13, if we could, please, where you talk about transfer of risk from employers to employees and the investment risk transferring, that the employees are actually having more risk now because of that? I'm curious how that comes about.
Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, Representative Vogel, thank you. It's actually worth noting that the point that I just made with regard to changes to employee contribution rates, the implementation in some cases of variable contribution rates for employees that can rise or fall depending on external factors, one of which is the performance of the plan's assets. So in that case, employees are experiencing a higher relative share of the investment risk than they were when their contribution rates were stable, regardless of the performance of the plan's assets. So that's one way. Another way is through the use of alternative plan design, such as a hybrid plan, in which a component of the retirement benefit is based on the accumulated value of the individual's defined contribution account. That an employee participating in a hybrid plan is certainly bearing more of the investment risk than an individual participating in a traditional defined benefit plan.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow-up. So I guess I can understand in a defined contribution, but in the defined benefit, there are some states that are actually increasing the employee contribution if indeed the investment return drops?
Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, yes, that's right. Pennsylvania is one of those states. Typically it's not something that occurs every year. It's you know, taking a five-year average return. If the five-year average return is below the plan's assumed rate of return, then employee contributions can automatically increase without the need for the legislature to take action.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Moving on to states that reduce pension benefits, we identify 40 states on this map, and this map covers actions such as lower benefit multipliers, increased eligibility requirements, longer vesting periods, increased requirements for age and service required to attain eligibility for normal retirement, unreduced retirement. Also, a lengthened period used to calculate final average salary, typically from 3 years to 5 years, which other factors equal, produces a smaller pension benefit. Next is states that reduce automatic cost of living adjustments, and there's a little bit more granularity on this map. COLA cuts fell into one of three broad categories, changes affecting new hires only. Those are the states shaded in teal or green. Cuts affecting current employees as well as new hires. Those are the blue states. And the prevailing change was cuts affecting cost of living adjustments paid to retired members. Those are the states in beige. Typically, all of the changes affecting retiree COLAs were challenged in court. And most courts, but not all, did affirm the state's right to make that change affecting retiree COLA. It's also worth noting on this map that there are several states, several very large states, such as Texas, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, there's New Hampshire, and others, that do not provide an automatic COLA of any type. They only provide an ad hoc COLA as granted by another entity, which could be the retirement board or the legislature. So essentially, states that provide an ad hoc COLA don't have anything to cut. So if it looks like this change was not as common as other types of changes, that may be one factor why. With regard to the types of changes, we saw, a number of states have employed a contingent COLA for many years, which broadly refers to a COLA whose provision and amount depends on external factors such as the plan's funding condition or the performance of the plan's assets. And a common change has been to lower the threshold, increase the threshold in this instance, required to provide a COLA. Moving on to hybrid plans, we observe new hybrid plans created in states seemingly every year. Typically, these plans apply to new hires only, although in limited cases, current employees have been required to participate in newly created hybrid plans. There are two prevailing types of hybrid plan, typically defined benefit, defined contribution combination hybrid plans, which typically marry a reduced defined benefit with a mandatory participation in an individual account, such as a 401k plan, and the other type being cash balance plans, which include features of both common to both defined benefit and defined contribution plans. Typically, cash balance plans produce a benefit based on the accumulated value of a notional account that receives a guaranteed rate of interest each year. Most cash balance plans also provide for the possibility of sharing increased interest credits in certain circumstances. It's also worth noting with regard to hybrid plans that several plans that are typically characterized as traditional defined benefit plans do include hybrid type features, features that are designed to distribute a portion of the risk from the employers to the employees. One of the examples that I mentioned previously is variable contribution rates. Plans that employ variable contribution rates could be characterized as defined benefit plans, but a variable contribution rate is also a hybrid type feature. So this is all to say that the terminology for hybrid plans is it's not necessarily binary. There can be plans that aren't typically thought of as hybrid plans that include hybrid features. So that's just something worth noting. So I have some more maps. The first is identifies the statewide hybrid plans in place in 1995. And this is a heat map. So the darker shaded the state is, the higher relative percentage of public employees in that state covered by the hybrid plan. In Indiana, most public employees have participated in a combination hybrid plan since the 1940s. In Texas, municipal and county workers have been in a cash balance plan since the 1950s. But by and large, in 1995, that was it. Move ahead to 2017, and we can see that as a plan design, hybrid plans have increased considerably. Although it's also worth noting that in many states in which a hybrid plan is present, the hybrid plan is an option for public employees, so not necessarily a mandatory plan for public employees, and as such, a relatively small percentage of public employees in some states, California, Colorado, Ohio being three examples, hybrid plan participation remains quite low. In a number of other states, hybrid plans are mandatory, but they're newly created, so we should expect participation in hybrid plans in certain states such as Tennessee, Virginia, Kansas, and others to increase as new individuals are hired under the new hybrid plans in those states. The next series of slides focuses on the normal cost, so I wanted to spend a moment introducing the concept of the normal cost. I mentioned it in relation to my comments on the ARC and ADC previously, but just to reiterate, the normal cost refers to the cost of benefits being accrued in a given year, generally expressed as a percentage of covered employee payroll. Employee and employer contributions both fund the normal cost, and as I'm going to discuss it momentarily, the normal cost can serve as a proxy measure for the value of a pension benefit. So essentially, a higher normal cost indicates a benefit with a greater value than a lower normal cost. So the first chart reflects a distribution of normal costs for general employees and teachers participating in Social Security in FY16. This chart includes 60 plans, each plan represented by one bar. Median normal cost is approximately 11%. I've indicated the relative position of the para, MSRS, and TRA. Normal cost for each of those plans is considerably less than the median. It's also worth noting that these are aggregate data. So in some cases, especially where benefits have been reduced for new hires, you'll have a lower normal cost for new hires relative to employees participating in the prior tier, the closed plan. But this data aggregates everything together. So that's a point worth noting with regard to this chart and the next chart. And the next chart identifies the distribution of the percentage of normal cost paid by employees, general employees and teachers for FY16. So as I mentioned, employee and employer contributions typically fund the normal cost. This is the percentage of the normal cost, essentially the percentage of their own benefit that employees are funding through their own contributions. Median is just over 50%, approaching 56%. And the relative position of the three statewide plans here in Minnesota is indicated. So public employees in Minnesota typically fund a higher relative percentage of their own retirement benefit than do median employee nationwide. So the final section in my presentation is going to address changes that we've observed to the investment return assumption. Of all of the actuarial assumptions used by public retirement systems, the investment return assumption is perhaps the most consequential. That is because over a long period of time, public retirement system expects to earn most of its revenue from investment returns, over 60% for a 30-year period looking backwards. As such, even a small change to the investment return assumption can impose a disproportionate impact on a plan's liabilities and costs. So it's a very important assumption. Retirement systems typically change their return assumption in response to actuarial experience studies, a study of their assets and liabilities, and the performance of their actuarial assumptions for a given time period. Typically, retirement system boards are tasked with making changes to the assumed rate of return, but Minnesota is one of three states, others being South Carolina and Washington, where the legislature is responsible for making change to that assumption. Actuarial experience studies include capital market assumptions, which are generally consensus forecasts of the assumed investment returns for the individual asset classes that comprise the fund's total portfolio. And what we've observed is in the wake of the most recent capital market decline has produced a period of low global interest rates, low inflation, at least relative to historic norms for those measures. And in response to that, we have seen an unprecedented wave of reductions to retirement system assumed rates of return, particularly since 2009. And as I note on this slide, we produce a standing issue brief on public pension plan investment return assumptions that is a very helpful reference for more information on this subject. This chart, it reflects the trend in the number of reductions to assumed rates of return for the plans that we regularly monitor. Each different colored or shaded bar represents an assumed rate of return or a range of assumed rates of return. For example, the sort of royal blue shaded bar represents an 8% return assumption. And you can see that the median assumed rate of return was at 8% for many years and has since been reduced to 7.5%. Additionally, we see the near disappearance of assumed rates of return at 8.5% or higher, and the emergence of assumed rates of return below 7% beginning in recent years and continuing. I've also identified the current assumed rates of return for the three statewide systems here in Minnesota. I'd like to wrap up by identifying what NASRA believes is the key challenge facing public pension stakeholders and governing authorities, and that is providing a retirement benefit that aligns with key stakeholder objectives. So who are the key stakeholders? Well, we identify three: public employees, public employers, and taxpayers. And what do they want? By and large, public employees want competitive compensation that includes a stable and secure component for retirement income. Public employers want to be able to recruit and retain a qualified public workforce while keeping costs stable and predictable over time. And taxpayers want reliable and efficiently delivered public services delivered by professionals and at the lowest cost possible. We believe that it is possible to provide a retirement benefit, to structure a retirement plan that meets the objectives of all of these stakeholders, and generally we observe that such a plan contains some key distinguishing elements we refer to as distinguishing elements of retirement plan design. The first is mandatory participation. Most employees in the public sector do not have to make an active decision to join their retirement plan. They're automatically enrolled in the plan that pertains to their, perhaps their date of hire, their occupation. This is in contrast to the private sector, where employees typically have to make an active election to join an employer-sponsored retirement plan if one exists. Public employees, as I've identified throughout my remarks, share in the cost of financing, share with employers the cost of financing their own retirement benefit. Public pension benefits for public employees are generally intended to replace a target percentage of income in retirement. Again, this contrasts with the private sector, where the benefits are typically equal to the accumulated balance of an individual's defined contribution account. Public pension assets are pooled and professionally invested, again, in contrast to the private sector, where an individual is generally responsible for managing their own retirement assets. Public pension benefits, most retirement systems provide death and disability protection, and at least a portion, if not all, of the public pension benefit is paid in the form of an annuity, which provides a retiree with a benefit that cannot be exhausted or outlived, again, in contrast to the private sector. That is the end of my prepared remarks, and I've included my contact information for follow-up, and if there are questions, I would be happy to take them at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Any questions? I do have a question, Mr. Brown. 2015, we did a mortality study, and we were going to have the state demographer, Ms. Brower, come up here shortly. Is that something most of the states have been working on? And because that really did kind of upset things, and we had to move into a bill, a very good pension compromise of 2017, that I don't know if you've had a chance to review the pension bill from last year. So there's two questions there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good question. I'll address the second part first. I have not reviewed the specifics of last year's pension bill here in Minnesota. But with regard to your first question, nearly every retirement system engages in an actuarial experience study, typically every 5 years. And this includes a review of all actuarial assumptions, including assumed mortality rates. And mortality experience is something that is tends to be very specific to a locality. I know here in Minnesota, I've understood for years that individual mortality rates are quite low, I guess, to use the actuarial parlance, relative to other states. So I can tell you that is something that all states are reviewing. I don't have any more information on broader trends, but it does tend to be something that is sort of, differs from state to state.
Mm-hmm. Well, that mortality experience did make us stop and reset the button. Is there anything else that you see coming down the pipeline that we should be taking a look at?
Certainly the performance of the capital markets is going to be something to watch. As I mentioned, most retirement systems have reduced their assumed rates of return to reflect diminished expectations for long-term capital market performance. I think that, along with perhaps for some states, improving mortality rates will present funding challenges for pension plan sponsors, and those are things to keep an eye on.
Great. Thank you. Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank Mr. Brown. It was a great presentation, very informative on the information that was presented, and probably a little jealous of Senator Friends here, who it took me a while to get such a great overall view of what's going on in pensions in his first meeting.
Senator France.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, thanks for welcoming me to the committee. Thanks, Senator Jasinski. Thanks, Mr. Brown. We're talking about how to protect the public employees best and what the state of Minnesota wants to look at in making those decisions, and I'm looking forward to it. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Franson. Actually, Senator Jasinski preempted me on that. I was going to welcome you, but he caught me to the first. So thank you for serving on this very, very important commission, Senator Franson. Yes, it's great to have you. Mr. Brown, thank you so much. Further questions, comments? Thank you for making the trek up north here. Really appreciate it. It was very, very, very interesting. We appreciate it.
Thank you for your attention.
And next, we have Ms. Brower, our state demographer. She's going to report on trends and forecasts for public employment in Minnesota. Good morning, or good afternoon, Ms. Brower.
Good afternoon.
And while you're getting set up, I also want to welcome back Ms. Amy Strange, our Senate Republican counsel. She had a baby, and she's back, and I think she's thrilled to be back. So where is she? When you are ready, Ms. Brower.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Susan Brower. I'm the state demographer, and I work in the Department of Administration. Thanks for having me here today. I don't want to give any of you vertigo or whiplash or anything, but we're going to back up a little bit and look at some of the big picture demographic changes that shape why we're looking at this issue and that will shape the context with which future pension policy will unfold. And so with that, just as lengthening life expectancies have increased pension liabilities, some of these related demographic shifts are continuing to unfold that will help shape the future of state government and the state workforce, and that's what I'll talk about with you today. Thank you. So I want to talk briefly about three major demographic trends to consider as you continue your work on this planning commission. These three trends are population aging, shifts in the labor force that are related to population aging, and the growing racial and ethnic diversity of the state. These demographic trends will alter the absolute and relative size of population groups and require deliberations about whether and how the state should shift its policy, its programs, and its resources. Although the demographic shifts will start settling in over the next couple of decades, the resulting composition that we have here as a state will be more or less permanent. We're making a shift right now to a new age structure, and that will stay in place into the foreseeable future. And so the policies and the decisions that we're putting in place today are really realigning to the demographic realities that have emerged and will continue to emerge over the next couple of decades. It's in this context that the future public pension system will be couched, and so that is the basis for some of these statistics that I'll share with you today. I would just add to the life expectancy discussion, indeed Minnesota has one of the longest life expectancies, second only to Hawaii. At age 65, a Minnesota resident can expect to live 20 years on average, and that's, as I said, very high relative to the rest of the U.S. We would expect that would continue to lengthen over time. We have seen recent setbacks in terms of lengthening life expectancy over all ages, but that's coming really from mortality in the middle years. So if we're talking about life expectancy at age 65, we would expect that to continue to lengthen over time. Increasingly, in the coming decades, Minnesota and its workforce will continue to become older. The labor force will slow its growth dramatically as a result of that aging. Right now, Minnesota is on the cusp of an era in which its older adult population, those who are 65 plus, will surge to a figure that's several orders of magnitude larger than what our state experienced just half a century ago. And so to give you a sense of what this looks like, we can see from this graph that Minnesota's older adult population between 2010 and 2030 will grow from about 680,000 older adults to about 1.3 million by 2030. You can see that, you know, if you look at the youngest age group there in blue, that growth was happening in the 1950s and up to the early 1960s, so that's when the baby boomers were entering the scene. That shifted to growth in the working age years, 18 to 64, the red line there. You can see rapid growth from about 1970 up to 2010. And now that the baby boom generation is leaving the workforce, we see that growth really happening in that age 65 plus. So I draw that all out just to say that this is marching forward in time. The folks that we already have here, our residents who are already here, it's very easy to predict, and it's inevitable that the changes will continue to unfold. So here's where we are right now, the changes here. So for the first time in our state's history, we'll have by 2030 as many older adults as we have young children, 0 to 18, and in fact, those two lines cross even earlier if we're looking at school-age children. That happens by about 2020. And so we expect that as a result, public budgets will need to shift, institutions will likely shift, and the way that our communities are organized will shift as well. I think it helps to think about the transitions that we're experiencing now as a result of aging along a timeline, and we can see that between about 2011 and 2030, it's when the baby boomers are exiting the labor force, and that's where we really start to feel the impact, and we already have begun to feel the impact of aging on our workforce and what it means to employers to find workers. The aging of the population really occurs later as baby boomers move into those older ages. If we look at the proportion of the state that is dependent, meaning out of the workforce, that's the demographer's term for it, I guess, the dependency ratio, you can see that overall the number of dependents, including older adults and young children, will be growing at the same time that the share of working age will be declining. It's just that shift that I talked about that's more or less inevitable, but that's the reality of the transition that we're moving into right now, and it has implications for economic output, economic growth. It has implications for where the demand is. Sometimes I sound like I'm the Grim Reaper or something. It's really just the outcome of who we are now as we move forward in time, and our job is to realign to this new demographic reality. So if we think about those shifting age demographics and we look at just the general fund state budget, I know it's a different committee, but I want you to consider for a moment the context of the budget going forward when you're thinking about, the issue of pensions, just what will be happening with the state budget otherwise. And if we look at where the largest groups, where the largest proportion of the state budget, the general fund, is spent, you can see large proportions in K-12 education, which correlate with our 5 to 17-year-old population, and also with health and human services, about 30%, which not all, but a large proportion is related to the elderly, in particular long-term care, medical expenditures, MA expenditures. We've looked just at what increasing enrollment will do to long-term care, and we expect that the MA long-term care services, a rough estimate is that will go from about $1.1 billion to about $3.8 billion by 2040. Those are annual costs. So this cost will be growing at the very same time that liabilities for pensions are growing. It's just part of the larger economic context that we will experience in the coming years. This is the era into which we are moving.
Ms. Brown,
on the previous page, you have MA expenditures for elderly and disabled at 16%. Do you have a figure for what how that's going to increase in the same time period?
Madam Chair, I don't. That was based on a point in time estimate, and what we've done to look at with DHS is to look at what increasing enrollments would do to MA expenditures, particularly around long-term care, if the same services were to remain constant and assuming a constant rate of inflation. So it's a very rough estimate, but we don't have a sense of what the overall budget would be to compare that percentage to, or to make a percentage out of it.
And you just made that those figures on the same services that were being provided, right? You didn't look at other services added or decreased or anything.
That's right, exactly. Okay. So this is based on what it costs right now, and based on current enrollments. If we just look at what enrollment increase would do at the same level of service with a constant rate of inflation, that's the number that we would arrive at.
I'm putting my finance chair hat on.
Thank
right
you.
Now.
I appreciate it, yes. And these are outlined in our report, which can be found online. It's called the Demographic Considerations for Long Range and Strategic Plan, and some of the assumptions are built in there. My point isn't that it must increase to that amount. It's that if we continue marching along as we are right now, that's where the cost grows to, just because of aging, not because of the policy piece.
Okay.
So how we fund, in general, how we fund pension liabilities in the future is part of the larger picture of how we fund state government services generally. It doesn't appear to me, and I'll show you in a moment why, that we can expect the level of growth that we've seen in the past, just given what our labor force growth will look like. And there will be, tough decisions to make to decide just how we can continue to afford the services that we receive now. It'll be some tough decisions. I want to talk about what the aging trend does to workforce changes in the state workforce in particular, and what that means for the attraction and retention of state workers and workers in general, the competition for workers. And we've made some projections about what the labor force will look like in the future. We expect that the growth will be very little going forward. In the past, and about in the 1990s, the labor force, all the people in Minnesota who were available to work, this is private sector, public sector together, grew by about 54,000 people each year during that decade, or about 540,000 over the course of the decade, and you can see that number has declined considerably until today, where we have almost no growth right now in the number of people who are available to work. That again is as the baby boomers move out of the workforce, it's really hard to keep up those growth levels. We've projected going forward that we expect there will continue to be very little growth, which says that the number of people, close to the number of people that we have here now, is very close to the number that we'll have in 15 years available to work. And so while other things may change in terms of technology, in terms of what employers' demand is, these things are fairly predictable given past trends in employment, past trends in migration, and mortality. We've taken into
Ms. Brower. Senator Lower.
Ms. Brower, these are figures that are based on no change in public policy. Is that correct?
Ms. Brower.
Madam Chair, Senator, these are figures that are based on demographic projections based on the life expectancy of our population, based on labor force participation that we've seen historically. And so we take the population that we expect to have and the migration patterns that we've seen recently. And so we take what we have seen recently in terms of population growth, and we see what's happened in terms of labor force participation, including the growth of the older adult population and apply that to the population growth that we've projected.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, I can understand where you're arriving at these figures, but that's not to say that we couldn't change the outcome if we purposely decided to make certain policy changes in the state of Minnesota. Take, for example, there are some states that have revised their business attitude, and they have actually pulled people from northern states into southern states because of their policies on business climate. They've purposely attracted businesses to their state, which in turn has attracted a workforce from other areas. So this is, in a way, this kind of creates creates what I might call a doom and gloom scenario. No growth, we're going to shrink our workforce, tax revenue will slow, and we can avoid that if we make purposeful changes, if we decide to make the state into a different direction. And so am I correct in this, in my view of these numbers and what it could become?
Ms. Brown.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, absolutely, the future is wide open. But what I can tell you is that we've already built into these projections increased migration that we think will happen because of the labor force shortages. So we do project considerable increase in migration over this time period already. We've seen a little bit of that, but it hasn't fully, you know, turned around what we might expect. But certainly there may be policy levers that could change that. We may see different labor force participation rates, you know, may also be a lever of public policy as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Ms. Brower.
I mentioned that we took into account increasing labor force participation rates when we made these projections. We did take into account increased rates of migration, that we expect to see that going forward. And still, it makes it very difficult to grow just because the size of the baby boom generation is so large that it's not that it's impossible, but it's going to be a neat trick, I think. Right now, we also have a situation where we have the same number of people, roughly, the same number of people who are unemployed or actively looking for work as the number of job vacancies, which, of course, doesn't mean that everyone should have a job. There's other kinds of mismatches in terms of spatial mismatches, in terms of geographic mismatches, but it just points to the fact that there's a very tight labor market right now, that there are a low relative number of people looking for work than employers may be used to. What we see if we look at the state workforce is that the workforce has been aging. The yellow line here is showing you the age distribution of state government workers in 2003 compared to 2014. And you can see that shape that looks to me something like an elephant might be shifting forward just a little bit each year as that group ages out. This age distribution looks a little bit different from the total Minnesota workforce in that we have longer retention typically of our workers, and so we have a somewhat older workforce than we see statewide if we look at all sectors.
Ms. Brower, older workforce, but is our average retirement age longer, older in Minnesota then?
Madam Chair, the age is a bit younger than overall, about a year younger on average. There's a number of different ways that you can measure it, but if you look at some of the very basic measures, it looks to be just slightly shorter than the average. And so we can see, looking at the state government workforce, that there's a large proportion who are set to move over that retirement age in the coming years, that we expect to see continued numbers of retirements that we've already begun to see, and that we have a relatively small proportion of younger workers behind coming to fill those spots, at least in place right now. This is what the workforce looks like across private and public sectors together. So you can see that the proportion of workers statewide is much more distributed at the younger ages as well. So I'll just go back once. There's the state workforce. And there we have the state overall, not just state government. The final trend I want to touch on that gives additional context for what the state workforce will look like in the coming years is the increasing racial and ethnic diversity, which will impact the state workforce as well. Right now, about 1 million residents in Minnesota are people of color, or about 20% of the population. That growth has happened primarily since about 1990 and continues through the most recent data that we have. We're still largely 81% a white non-Hispanic state, but that's becoming less so as the growth is coming primarily from populations of color. One of the issues that we see again and again is the disparities between racial groups, and here we're looking at median household income across groups. And what I can say is that we've seen some increase in well-being with respect to this measure and other measures as well for many populations, including populations of color, since the recession, but that the disparities between groups remains. What we know about our workforce is that increasingly as we go down the age ladder to the younger ages, we see a much higher proportion of people of color in the younger age groups. And so these disparities, particularly with respect to educational attainment and skills training, are particularly concerning given the tight labor market that we have and the relatively little growth that we expect in the future. So these are the major shifts that I see impacting state government and the state government workforce in the coming years. Public pensions are one of the ways that the state has attracted its workers in the past and retained its workers in the past. That's why we see that older age structure, I believe. And the current older age distribution of the state's workforce reflects the ability of defined compensation benefits to retain workers for a long time. So given a tight labor market and little labor force growth expected ahead, the attraction and retention of government workers will take on heightened importance as the competition for workers heats up. At the same time, the aging trend will increase the demand for public services. And so it is not an easy place to be in by any means, and our demographics are certainly shifting us ever more toward these changes, whether or not we're ready for them. That's the end of my prepared remarks. I'm happy to take any additional questions.
Thank you, Ms. Brower. Any questions for our state demographer? Well, it was fascinating. I have to say it's a bit of a reality check. Every time you see a presentation like this, did a very nice job. It's a little depressing, I have to say. But I couldn't agree with you more that it definitely does help attract and retain our workforce, and that's critical for the state, just for the health of the state. Keeping the pension and the accessibility and a strong pension plan there is very, very important to our workforce. So further questions? Thank you, Ms. Brower.
Thank you.
Okay, members, we are going to go. I'm going to turn this over to Ms. Lincheski and Ms. Barth, and they're going to talk about the Volunteer Firefighter Relief Association pension update. Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We asked Senator Rosen if we could include this on our agenda because we have been spending increasingly more time as staff over at the LCPR office on Volunteer Firefighter Relief Association issues. And it seems to us that there is likely a need to look at this a little more closely in the months to come. I don't know whether we can get anything legislatively, but certainly in the next year or two, there's some work to be done here. What we're seeing is that fire state aid is being paid into these plans in amounts that really have no don't appear to have any relationship to what's an appropriate retirement benefit for firefighters. And it's also very unequal. There's no equity or any sort of equalizing among the outstate firefighters versus the metro. And so what we're seeing is that there are some, in particularly metro or large city relief associations, that have significant overfunding. And so there is some issues that are coming out of that. And we're just beginning to understand what this all means. But what we're seeing is that there's a transition in some of these metro areas from a relief association providing volunteers that take care of the firefighting needs of the metro area to situations where the city is employing firefighters on a full-time basis, meaning that they aren't needing to use the volunteers anymore. So there's questions about what to do with this large number of assets sitting there that are for relief associations. And there seems to be some municipalities that feel that they could use those assets for their own firefighting needs as it relates to these now salaried firefighters. So that's kind of an overview of just what we're seeing, but we're really at the start of understanding what's happening here with the system. So I will just mention what one group is doing, and there are actually three groups that are dealing with firefighters. One is the statewide plan advisory board, and Shana Jones, I hope, is here and can come up and speak to what that advisory board is doing. She'll speak after Rachel and I. I will be giving just a short overview of what is called the Volunteer Fire Relief Association Working Group, and that's the group that's chaired by the state auditor, Auditor Otto. That group, and then Rachel will follow with another group that is looking at it's a work group looking at the state aid allocation. As I mentioned, there's a lot of state aid going into these relief associations, and there is some interest in allocating that state aid between the city that is associated with the relief association and the relief association. So that's a separate issue that's being looked at by another work group.
Ms. Lucheski, before you continue, does that have to be done legislatively, or can they just do that in-house?
The allocation.
Allocation, right.
Yeah, it has to be done legislatively.
Okay, thank you.
And Rachel will explain how there is a start at doing that in our current pension bill. But this group is looking at it in a broader application. So the Volunteer Fire Relief Association Working Group has been meeting for many years, since about 2004, convened by the state auditor. And they're looking at issues generally arising with the relief associations and then putting together legislative proposals. The group is comprised of two representatives from municipalities and eight reps from the fire relief associations. This whole system is further complicated by the fact that some relief associations pay pension benefits in the form of either a monthly pension or a lump sum benefit. Other relief associations are set up as defined contribution plans, and they have defined contribution accounts that get an allocation of this state aid. The group meets on and off throughout the fall, typically. They hadn't been meeting this fall because of the number of legislative proposals that they already have in our pension bill. So the thought was that there wasn't a need. But because of some of these issues that are coming to the front, as far as municipalities being concerned with one particular provision in our pension bill, the thought was to put the group together again and have a couple of meetings They've had two now, one on January 17th and another on January 31st. The explicit, or really the focus of the group for these two meetings was to look at the proposal in our pension bill right now, which is to increase the lump sum maximum from $10,000 to $15,000. And this is an amount that is multiplied by the number of years of service to produce a lump sum benefit at retirement age for the firefighters. The group had received a number of comments from municipalities. Reps from municipalities attended the meetings, spoke up, made their position clear on this issue. The fire relief associations, of course, are in favor of this lump sum increase because there are some of these associations that are currently at $10,000 as the lump sum amount and would be eligible to increase, probably not up to $15,000, but somewhere in the neighborhood of $12,000 to $13,000 as soon as this legislation passes, in which case their overfunding would decline because they now have bigger benefits that they're going to be paying. So after much discussion and at the end of these two meetings, a vote was taken, and the working group voted unanimously with one abstention to approve or to concur with the legislation as it currently is in our bill. So that's really what is now underway. So that's the end of the group's work this session. So we'll be looking at this more, I think, as we move forward with the pension bill. But that is the most recent issue. As I mentioned, there are others that I'm hoping the working group will look at next fall. But we will continue to work on these issues over in the LCPR staff office.
Any questions? Members? Ms. Lucheski, was this on the Austin?
Actually, Rachel's going to talk on the Austin issue, which is the allocation of state aid.
I see. Okay. Questions? All right. Ms. Barth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So last session, the Pension Commission approved a provision that created the Fire State Aid Work Group to meet during the interim and provide a recommendation to the Pension Commission for the 2018 legislative session. This provision was in response to the City of Austin's special legislation, and just kind of as a brief reminder, Austin is currently splitting their fire state aid or allocating their fire state aid between its Volunteer Relief Association and their para police and fire employer obligations on behalf of their full-time firefighters. This was allowed under an older law that was actually repealed in 2013, but Austin was unaware of that repeal, so they continued this allocation. So the special legislation would allow Austin to continue this allocation. And the work group was created to get stakeholder input on whether it was appropriate to revise the law to allow all combination fire departments, so those fire departments that have both volunteers and full-time firefighters, to use a portion of fire state aid to pay para PNF employer contributions. So as we all know, the bill was vetoed. But there was still a lot of stakeholder interest in having the work group since the issue was going to be coming up at the Pension Commission again in 2018. So the work group commenced as if the law had passed. So it includes 8 members who represent cities, firefighters, state auditor's office, and then the Department of Revenue, who does all the calculations and distribution of the fire state aid. There have been 3 meetings so far, November, January, and February. So para staff, LCPR staff, we've provided scheduling the meetings and information that's been requested by the members. And the group has looked at the history of fire state aid and the demographic and financial data of the state's combination fire departments just to kind of get an idea of the impact if general legislation were to come forward or that they would recommend it. And they are currently considering the options and possible examples of legislation. So that's kind of where we're at now. There's no been final decision for the group.
Thank you, Ms. Barth. Any questions? Okay, great. Hello, Ms. Jones. Come on up. And you are going to talk about the Para Statewide Voluntary Firefighters Retirement Plan Advisory Board. As an update, please. Thank you.
That's right. Good afternoon now, members of the Commission, Madam Chair. My name is Shana Jones, Policy Director at PERA. So PERA administers a statewide volunteer firefighter retirement plan. We call it the SVF plan, so if you hear that, that's what that means. For local governments who have volunteer firefighters that elect to participate in our plan, the plan was established in 2010, and we currently have 142 participating entities that cover about 3,400 members. We have another 17 that are set to join in 2018 now. As of November 2017, the plan had over $82 million in assets and ended the calendar year with a 13-plus percent rate of return. So when the plan was established in 2010, it only allowed for defined benefit lump sum payments at retirement. Under this structure, vested members receive an amount certain that ranges anywhere from $500 to $7,500 per year of service that they provide to the fire department. And they get that in the form of a one-time lump sum payment at retirement. In 2015, authorization was, or language was added that allowed us to do monthly benefits. We're currently only administering one of those for Spring Lake Park, so most of our administration is for the lump sum payments. Also, the funding for these benefits typically comes mostly from fire state aid. Only about 10% of our participating entities actually make a contribution in excess of that. Of their aid amount. So an advisory board was established in Chapter 353G to advise our PERA Board of Trustees on the issues that are related to the administration of this plan, and that's composed of representatives from cities, townships, firefighters, and fire chiefs. That group had some recommendations last year. They did not come out with anything new for 2018 because we just plan to continue to pursue the three changes that were adopted last year. And it's also worth noting that these changes were all reviewed by participants of the group and did have significant input, and so we believe that they're agreeable to all of the parties that were there and anyone who's going to be impacted by them. Excuse me. So as a reminder, the three changes that were included in the omnibus bill last year sought to change the advisory board composition so that the number of members appointed by the Minnesota State Fire Department Association matched the number that was appointed by the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association. The second change was to make the annual maximum service pension level to be consistent with what's allowed for VRFAs under Chapter 424A. Right now, we're not even close to our $7,500 threshold in our current law. I think the highest one I found was about $3,500 per year of service, and on average, it's just under $1,400 per year of service that participants in our plan receive for every year of service. But it was mainly coming from consistency, just consistency in treatment of our SVF participants compared to the VRFA participants. And then the third change that our advisory board sought was allowing participants to withdraw from our SVF plan. Currently, once you're in the SVF plan, you cannot leave the SVF plan. And this discussion sort of came out of two different entities that were seeking to merge and form a new fire district. One of the entities participated in our SVF plan, and the other had a relief association. And it was the desire of those groups to take the assets and the benefits due from the SVF plan and transfer them all to the relief association under the control of the new fire district. But there was not any authorization. So when our advisory board weighed in on this, they felt like that was not an issue specific to those two entities, that in fact many relief associations are hesitant to join the SVF plan because not only do they give up some control of their own relief association, but they don't have an option to withdraw. And so we did seek to make that legislation broad for anyone.
Any questions for Ms. Jones? Thank you, Ms. Jones. That was very informative. Appreciate that. A little update on all those changes on the voluntary firefighters. Yes, Senator Frantz.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to chase down Ms. Jones, but I did have one question, if you have a moment, please. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Absolutely. Ms. Jones?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Jones, just for those of us from the outstate, what's the percentage of volunteer firefighters compared to the total in the non-metro areas? Do you have an idea? I've heard numbers as high as 90-93%. Or do we have someone here that knows that? In other words, what's the ratio of volunteers to everybody in the outstate?
And Senator France, if she does not know that, we can get that figure to the whole commission. But Ms. Jones?
Madam Chair, Senator France, I don't know that off the top of my head, and I'm not even positive who would have that data. I'm looking at Ms. Martz to know if we have it readily available or if we'd have to do some work to compile it.
Ms. Martz?
Madam Chair, we'd have to compile it. I don't have that on me right now.
That's fine. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator
Thank
France.
Thank you, Ms. Jones.
I would, too, be interested in knowing what cities, municipalities are interested in switching over to full-time, from voluntary to full-time, the names of the cities, too. That'd be great. Thank you. Any further questions? With that, members, just our next meeting is on February 19th in room 1100, which is, I believe, this way, and in the in the Senate building here. It's at 1 o'clock, Senator Pappas. Thank you for reminding me there. We just have a couple motions that are in place to change our economic assumption. We'll have to have two motions, one for the rest of the plans, and then St. Paul Teachers has to have a separate motion for their economic assumptions, not the discount rate, but that we had it in the bill last year, and we need to get that motion going. We also are going to do a presentation from the Pew Charitable Trust, Mr. Timothy Dawson, Officer, State Policy Director for the Pew Foundations. Thank you, Representative Vogel and Senator Pappas, for your involvement in the Pew work there. Appreciate that. And also, we've got Mr. Robert Wiley, the Executive Director of South Dakota Retirement System, giving South Dakota's perspective. So with that, and then the next day, we start session. So game on. Further questions, comments? Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned.